is AT&T Mobility. And versus Yeager, and for the appellant on this case, we have John Williams, and for the appellee, we've got Todd Noonan, if I've got that right. So why don't we proceed with appellant's case?
Thank you and good afternoon. May it please the court, John Williams on behalf of the appellants. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal, and I'll keep an eye on the clock. I'm going to use my time this afternoon to put a finer point on a few key issues in this appeal. And the first issue I'm going to address is the district court's anti-SLAPP ruling. There are two key considerations this court should analyze de novo when examining the district court's anti-SLAPP ruling. One, whether the gravamen of the cross claims pled was to challenge or arose from protected activity. And two, whether Boland's refusal to provide an accounting of sums already collected was protected petitioning or expressive activity.
Well, I have a threshold question, which is whether we really need to address the SLAPP issue. Because as this was briefed to the district court, it was briefed as a 12B6 and as a SLAPP motion. And then the district court said that it was going to look at it as a SLAPP motion. But then in analyzing it, as I read the district court's order, the district court looked only at the pleadings and judicially noticeable materials. So could we just review this as a 12B6 and skip all the SLAPP issues? I mean, if the complaint didn't meet Iqbal Twombly in light of the pleadings and the judicially noticeable materials, the SLAPP issue seems to drop out of the case.
My response to that, Your Honor, was my understanding of the record was that the court denied the motion to dismiss as moot in light of its ruling on the anti-SLAPP issue, and that the parties have briefed the case with respect to the ruling that was actually made by the district court, which was an anti-SLAPP analysis and not a motion to dismiss. And so if the court were to decide it based on the motion to dismiss, it would be deciding it based on an unbriefed issue.
No, but you've had to address, in order to challenge the ruling, you had to address both aspects of the SLAPP ruling. So, the first part, whether SLAPP is triggered, and then the second part, whether you had made the showing required, to respond to the SLAPP motion. And that second part just overlaps it entirely. It's a 12B6 issue.
Well, our position, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, Your Honor. Our position is that Boland did not meet her initial burden of satisfying prong one of the anti-SLAPP analysis. And so the issues related to prong two, which I believe you're considering as being the same as would be considered in a motion to dismiss, never arise in this case.
No, but you briefed prong one and prong two, right? I mean, because you need both of them to win.
Well, no. If she doesn't satisfy prong one, then the anti-SLAPP motion is denied. And right, that's our position. That Boland has the initial burden to satisfy prong one and did not do so in this case. And therefore, the analysis on prong two is not required by this court. If this court agrees that prong one was not satisfied, that was Boland's burden, then prong two is not relevant to the consideration of any of those issues. And that's our position here.
So you concede that if we're in SLAPP, and you lose on prong one, you concede you lose on prong two.
We didn't challenge prong two in the appeal because we believe that prong one was not satisfied. But yes, we would concede that point if we do not prevail on prong one.
Run me through your argument on prong one because I'm inclined to be skeptical of it, but let me hear you state it in the best way you can.
Thank you, Your Honor. So the argument on prong one is that the gravamen of the cross claims was to seek an accounting from Bolin meant to address a good faith dispute concerning whether Bolin had already collected all funds to which she was legally entitled under the Bolin judgment. In particular, at the outset of those cross claims, the nature of the action describes how those cross claims arose out of Bolin's refusal to provide an accounting of money she had already collected to date and to recognize all debts to Bolin had been satisfied. Paragraphs 13 and 21 then explain how Bolin's former attorney, Mr. Serlin, claimed to have given a portion of the funds Bolin previously collected, approximately $120,000, to a Daniel Wilcoxon, counsel who had previously represented General Yeager. So this raised the concern that Bolin was remaining a claimant in the interpleader action, even after fully collecting on the Bolin judgment, to assist others in collecting against the interpled AT&T funds. Such a concern was reasonable, as Mr. Serlin never filed a formal dismissal of Bolin from the interpleader action, nor did Serlin expunge previously asserted notice of lien consistent with his prior claim that Bolin was entitled to all of the interpled AT&T funds. So by asserting those cross claims, Victoria Yeager did not challenge Bolin's prior collection through other legal means. Instead, the thrust of that action, the gravamen of that action, was to request a full accounting of all monies collected to date to ensure that Bolin was not overcollecting by remaining a claimant in the interpleader action for the benefit of others. Those cross claims would therefore permit the district court to examine and determine with certainty the exact amounts Bolin had previously collected, extinguish or expunge any existing liens asserted by Bolin on amounts already collected, and require the return of any funds overcollected by Bolin on behalf of others so they would be available to satisfy other competing interpleader claims and not be diverted to third parties. In the anti-SLAPP context, the critical consideration is whether the cause of action is based on the defendant's protected free speech or petitioning activity. Here, the cross claims were based on Bolin's continuing participation in the interpleader action, coupled with Bolin's refusal to account for all sums she previously collected, not on any prior collections actions taken outside the interpleader action, a fact that the district court acknowledged. At very most, those cross claims were triggered by or merely incidental to those past collections efforts, but did not arise out of them, as the City of Cotati case requires. This is particularly so given the nature of the accounting remedy. It is a species of disclosure predicated upon the plaintiff's legal inability to determine how much money, if any, remains due. When Victoria Yeager previously requested an accounting from Bolin of all sums previously collected, those requests were refused. Consequently, the conduct from which Victoria Yeager's cross claims arose is Bolin's refusal to account for the sums Bolin had collected to date on the Bolin judgment. But importantly, refusing or failing to account for sums collected is not a protected petitioning activity. And we cited the court to the Baharian case and to the Blackburn case for that proposition. So my best argument is the district court was mistaken when it misconstrued the gravamen of Victoria Yeager's cross claims and further failed to recognize that any connection it had to Bolin's lawful collection efforts were merely incidental. And as such, this court should conclude that Bolin failed to satisfy its threshold burden on prong one of the relevant anti-SLAPP analysis.
I still have trouble. I mean, I just went through again looking at the discussion in the district court's order on prong two, and it doesn't cite anything other than the complaint and request for judicial notice. It relies on a standing ground that seems, you know, to be unchallengeable from a 12b6 point of view. I mean, it just seems like we're almost like a setup to decide a difficult SLAPP issue when you don't even challenge the prong two, and the prong two was done as a 12B6, and there was a parallel 12B6 below. So this seems like it's pointless.
Judge Collins, my response is my client does not have the initial burden to demonstrate satisfaction of prong one.
Your client has the burden to plead sufficient facts in the cross complaint to establish her standing when she wasn't the judgment debtor. That's the ground. She wasn't the judgment debtor and she didn't have an assignment. And there are no facts in that cross complaint to satisfy those elements. This is an easy Iqbal Twombly case. Why, you know, she did it as slap. It could have been done as a 12B6. You don't contest the correctness of that analysis, which is fatal under 12B6. Why do we have to go through this gyration in this to decide this potentially difficult slap issue?
So two answers to your question, and thank you for both of those. First off, again, the burden was on Bolin to establish that this was protected activity and that the gravamen of the cause of action arose out of that protected activity. And so our challenge to the district court slap ruling is based upon prong one, and the issue of standing is a prong two analysis. And so our position is the district court got prong one wrong, misconstrued the gravamen of the cause of action for accounting. And in that respect, the issue of standing on prong two, the court need not reach it. If the court agrees that that prong one was not satisfied, that's not our burden to demonstrate that that was satisfied.
Mr. Williams, I'm sorry to interject, but did you want to hold to the further time for rebuttal?
I do. Thank you, Your Honor, and I will. I'll reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Okay. Mr. Noonan, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Todd Noonan appearing on behalf of the Bolin parties. And Judge Collins, I'm going to dispense with my introductory remarks and drive right at your question, which was, why does the district court address the slap issues when we also filed the 12B6 motion? And I think the answer to that question was mentioned by the district court, and it's certainly been mentioned by this court, including in panels that have included Judge Fletcher and Judge Gould. And that is the substantive protection, the very important substantive protection provided to defendants such as the Bolins when their petitioning activities, when their First Amendment activities are targeted by a lawsuit. And, you know, the discussion in Planned Parenthood, which postdates the district court's decision here, but emphasizes the substantive protection offered to the Bolins, particularly here through their attorney's fees award. And so I think the district court actually did it properly in terms of—
So you want to stay within the slap box because of the fees, even though the same outcome would come out under 12B6, because the fees, you get the fees if it's in the slap box, you'd rather stay there.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that is the real protection offered to someone like Bolin, who is targeted for, frankly, having tried to collect on their judgment. And while I recognize, I'll term it, you did not use these terms, I'll term it a hypothetically difficult slap question. It's really not a hypothetically difficult slap question. It is a dead bang slap lawsuit. You know, I stood before a different panel of this court 10 years ago, representing the Bolins as a defendant when they had been sued by General Yeager. And they prevailed and were awarded their attorney's fees. And then this court affirmed and awarded further attorney's fees. The Bolins then spent the next several years trying to collect on those two fee awards. And they did so entirely within the judicial system. They did so through liens in pending actions. They did so through an independent declaratory relief action. And they had a contempt proceedings that they brought against Mrs. Yeager in the underlying action that they prevailed in. And they brought actually engaged in a settlement discussion that was supervised by an Eastern District Magistrate judge, all of which should have put rest to this case.
So you don't contend that all collection activities are qualify for SLAPP protection at prong one?
Well, that's, I'm not sure how to read that, because I can envision improper collection activities. Somebody hires the guy with the lead pipe and says, pay up, Mrs. Yeager. But here we had judicial remedies. We had liens filed in lawsuits, which bring with it a panoply of protection. We had lawsuits filed in efforts to resolve conflicts. We had settlement conferences supervised by judges. And these are activities endorsed both by California state courts and by this court as protected petitioning activities. And so certainly with every single activity at issue in this case and every single activity challenged by Mrs. Yeager, we would say, yes, those absolutely arose out of protected activities.
Because the form of the, it's not so much that it's an execution of a judgment, it's that the form of the form of the execution of judgment was itself proceedings in a court.
Yes, certainly within the four corners in the context of this case, that's exactly right.
Okay.
As a practical matter, is Victoria Yeager judgment proof? I'm trying to figure out, really, assume you get an award of fees because we would affirm on the SLAPP ground. Are the fees collectible? I mean, does it make a practical difference?
Yes, it does, Your Honor. First of all, I have no reason to believe Mrs. Yeager is judgment proof. There's no evidence in the record to suggest that. She actually did satisfy the underlying district court judgment. And so those monies were paid by her. And so there's no reason for me to believe and no reason for me to represent to this court that she would somehow evade or not pay with respect to any further judgment of this court. With respect to the remainder of prong one, I know the court has gone through the cross complaint. It's really replete with references to past conduct by the Bolins. It speaks of their failing to recognize a satisfaction of judgment on multiple points, including paragraph one and paragraph 11. There's a direct allegation that they unlawfully continued with liens. There's a direct reference, a request for damages, and a contention of unjust enrichment, all of which is backward looking. Mr. Williams, in arguing just now, also made reference to what he termed failures by the Bolins in the interpleader action, failures to expunge liens or failures to dismiss claims. And I wanted to clarify for the court with respect to collection proceedings that neither of those activities were required. First, in the interpleader action, the Bolins didn't have a counterclaim or a cross-claim. They filed an answer. And their answer contended that they were entitled to money because at the time that they filed that answer, they had filed a lien in actually the underlying action, the AT&T action that proceeded to verdict and led to the amount that was placed into interpleader. And so that was the only basis for their claim when they got started in the AT&T action was that lien. There was no claim for the Bolins to dismiss. In 2015, they filed satisfactions of judgment in the Yeager versus Bolin case. That was their requirement under the California Code of Civil Procedure. They file and serve those two satisfactions, and that's the only obligation put on a creditor. There's no further action that they need to take. Their claims disappear as a matter of law.
So what's the reference in the cross complaint where there's a complaint that the Bolin cross defendants had not filed a satisfaction of judgment and had refused to do so?
So this is an allegation by Mrs. Yeager. She is contending that the Bolins should have filed the satisfaction sooner. I believe she argues that they should have done it as in March of 2014 rather than in the summer of 2015 when they did. And that actually emphasizes and draws out our point, Your Honor, that Mrs. Yeager is in fact challenging past collection activities through her cross complaint.
So at the time this cross complaint was filed and alleged that they had refused to filed a satisfaction of judgment, it had all, in fact, already been filed.
A year before.
Now, what about the further allegation? It's about a claim for an accounting that even though all these, you know, execution activities were undertaken, you ended up with more money than you were entitled to get. And this is an accounting of the excess sum.
That's correct. That is her claim. And frankly, the way you articulated it just now, Judge Collins, is different from the way that Mr. Williams articulated it in his remarks, because the way you argued and or suggested it would be pled is the way it would have to be pled. You need an underlying wrong in order to pursue an accounting. This is a case cited by the appellants, Prakash Palan, which essentially states there must be some underlying misconduct on the part of the defendant in order to...
That seems to be what paragraph 28 says. It says that the Bowling Cross defendants have been unjustly enriched in receiving monies from Victoria Yeager and General Yeager above and beyond the amounts due according to all judgments.
I don't know if we're talking past ourselves. Maybe I'm too fixated on the prong one inquiry. I would agree with you that that is what she alleges. She alleges overcollection. What I am suggesting to you is that overcollection only occurred through the judicial process. If it didn't actually occur, but if we're to take her allegations as true, the only overcollection could have taken place through collection on liens, through declaratory relief actions that were settled leading to entry of judgment, and through settlement conferences before Judge Newman. Those were the events that were brought before the district court through a request for judicial notice. Those are the events put at issue by the pleadings. All of those events arise from the Bolins' protected post-judgment collection activities, and thus would trigger prong one, irrespective of the remedy, the accounting remedy, that's then overlaid on that conduct.
So is any portion of the sum that is alleged to be overpaid, is any portion of that a check that was written by the Yeagers?
So this is a difficult question to me because we're in an alternate universe. There was no overpayment.
No, I understand.
But
I have to take this as...
Oh, no, of course, Your Honor. But if we look at the settlement conference that occurred before Judge Newman, and this is in the supplemental excerpts of record, there's the transcript of it. And it actually, you'll see Judge Newman go through with exhaustive care, trying to ensure that both sides fully understood, and Mrs. Yeager and General Yeager were physically present, my clients were present by phone. He goes through an exhaustive care, trying to make sure everybody understands we're reaching a deal here. And that leads to the payment of a check by General Yeager. And when he pays that check, the district court, the first judgment, was satisfied. This court's order awarding fees, the amount of those fees, had not yet come out by that time. And so that was an open issue. The Yeagers had agreed to write a check for that when that came out. They didn't do that. And that's why there was a supplemental effort by the Bolins to collect through one last litigation lien. And that was in the San Francisco Superior Court case. When that was done, the judgments were satisfied. This is August of 2015. And the satisfaction of judgment was filed.
Okay, so your position is that because all of the actual collection activities that are necessarily challenged in the cross complaint took place in the courts and not through other types of methods, that's what makes it slappable at prong one?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. And certainly we explored in our brief, and I will not burden with you now, the cases that in fact are quite on point in terms of describing the post-collection activities as being validated and recognized prong one activities. Moving on, in terms of prong two, I think we heard from the appellants that they did not challenge that through the opening brief, and so that issue has been waived. It's really been waived at two levels, not only as to standing, but as to the alternative grounds to affirm, which in our view would very much include the litigation privilege in this case. Same too with the award of attorney's fees. No challenge was raised by the appellant with respect to that award of attorney's fees, assuming that the prong one trigger has been met. Mr. Williams didn't have a chance, but I know it's an issue that's equally in dispute on this appeal, and that relates to the vexatious litigant ruling. And I'll keep my comments on that brief, just to emphasize that that is an abuse of discretion standard. And here you had a district court judge who was not only experienced, but very careful and very deliberate and incremental in how she approached not only this order, but frankly, the entire case. She had a claimant in in General Yeager who exhibited signs in front of her of losing competence. And she caught, because these litigants were in front of her frequently and in person, she noted that and imposed or requested the appointment of a guardian ad litem to protect General Yeager's interests. She exhibited the same care and caution with respect to this vexatious litigant order. She frankly didn't accept our first showing, but she has the right as the district court sua sponte under the DeLong case to continue forward with the vexatious inquiry. She asked us for supplemental briefing, which we provided. And that briefing is really quite comprehensive and substantial in demonstrating the type of abuse that Mrs. Yeager's litigation practices brought against the Bolins. And one of the points that's emphasized in the reply is this notion that 391B3 somehow doesn't extend beyond just the interpleader action. And running low on time, but I'll just emphasize for the court that the plain language of the statute speaks to any litigation. And so Judge Mueller clearly had the right to look beyond just the interpleader action before to see how that the Yeagers had targeted the Bolins with their actions. And with that, Your Honor, my time is up, and I thank you for your time and submit.
Thank you, Mr. Newton. Okay, Mr. Williams, you've got some rebuttal time.
Thank you, I appreciate that. I wanna turn back to the prong one of the slap analysis. Again, the challenge that was made by the cross claims was not to the legal process, the legal collection process that Bolin pursued in other actions to collect on the Bolin judgment. The district court acknowledged that in its ruling, that that was not the crux of the cross claims. The crux of the cross claims was that as late as June of 2015, Bolin had filed through Mr. Serlin a lien in the interpleader action, continued to maintain the previously pled position that the Bolins were entitled to the full amount of all of the AT&T funds that had been interpled. And so that triggered this concern that if in fact the Bolins had fully recovered what they were entitled to recover from these other legal processes, that with respect to their remaining involvement in the interpleader action, that there was a concern that they were over-collecting or remained in that action to assist the collection of other claimants. And that was based upon Serlin's representation that $120,000 of what they had collected was directed to someone else.
But I'm looking at the district court's ruling in the section on the gravamen of the complaint, and it says the record demonstrates that the Bolins satisfied their judgment exclusively through counsel and the courts. And it says Mrs. Yeager argues that they wrongfully overcollected on their judgment, but by challenging the judicially approved amounts the Bolins collected. So it seems to rely on the reading that the gravamen of the complaint is that they just are challenging collections that were done entirely through the courts.
That is true. That is the district court's ruling. What I'm suggesting to you is that that is incorrect, and that this court on de novo review should conclude otherwise. It should conclude that the gravamen of the complaint was to seek an accounting in the interpleader action of what had been collected already through those legal processes, because there was a concern that the Bolins remained involved as a claimant, as someone who had filed a lien and not expunged the lien in that interpleader action, and were seeking to collect additional funds. So rather than the legal process or the legal collection process being the gravamen of those cross claims, it was incidental to the cross claims. It triggered the cross claims, but the gravamen of those cross claims was simply to seek an accounting, which Bolin, through her attorney, had refused to provide. Then the accounting had been requested, and that accounting was denied. And so that is the activity that is being challenged by the cross claim.
Again, there was necessarily call into question the amounts that the courts allowed in the processes to enforce the liens, wouldn't it?
I think that it's related to that. I think it's incidental to that, and it then triggers the question of why Bolin remains in the interpleader action, why the notice of lien that Bolin filed as late as June of 2015 was never expunged. Consistent with Bolin's claim at that time that Bolin was entitled to all of the interpled funds, that claim never went away by way of Bolin's answer. So the law makes a distinction between a claim that arises out of protected activity, which is subject to a slap motion, and a claim that is merely triggered by that activity or is incidental to that activity. And it's our position that the district court got that distinction wrong, that in this instance, what was being challenged was the non-expressive, non-protected act of refusing to account for what had already been collected by Bolin through legal means or otherwise, and that the gravamen of the cross claims was to challenge that conduct, not to challenge the legal process that had already occurred previously. That triggered that concern, but it wasn't what was being challenged by way of these cross claims.
Thanks, Mr. Williams. I see you're about a minute over your time, and so we should bring your argument to a close.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. So unless there's further questions from the panel, we'll submit.
Okay, hearing none, this case will be submitted, and the parties will hear from us in due course. And again, I want to thank both Mr. Williams and Mr. Noonan for their advocacy to us. We really appreciate getting such excellent presentations on behalf of your respective clients. So thank you. With that, the case shall be submitted, and the court will take a 10-minute recess before proceeding to the Royal Holdings and Langer case arguments.